This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Today's episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Ponco Chicken. The new Atlanta restaurant thrives off of a unique spin on Japanese and Western cuisine and is already racking up the awards, winning best-selling taste in the Taste of Atlanta Awards both in 2017 and 2018. So if you're in the Metro Atlanta area and are wanting to try something new and good and delicious, go to Ponco Chicken today and tell them that I sent you over. You'll be glad you did, I promise. Ponco Chicken, where eats meets West.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, welcome back to the Chase Thomas Podcast. I am now joined by a fan of a team that in my lifetime, I am 27 years old. I don't recall any memorable season. I'm not old enough for the Doug Williams years or the Fran Tarkenton years. I'm old enough for the Jason Campbell years. I'm old enough for Colt McCoy getting inserted every now and then. I'm old enough for Mark Brunell. I'm sure I'm missing even more opportunities. Oh, Gus Frerotte. Who could forget Gus Frerotte and those legendary Redskins teams? But no, I'm sorry. I'm starting this off super negatively because he's very nice to come on this podcast to talk about a team that I'm sure he already thinks about and complains about it and just drive him nuts on a daily basis. It's Ken Marangolo of Hogshaven.com. Ken, good evening. How are you?
Fantastic. And yourself, Chase?
I'm not a Redskins fan, so I think that's somewhat better, right?
Well, I mean, thankfully, I watched with my very own eyes 3 Super Bowl wins, 4 total Super Bowls.
Okay.
I'm just a tick over 40 years old, so I was still pretty young when the Redskins beat Miami with Riggins and 4th-and-1 and all that stuff. We got trounced by the Raiders. I do remember that. That was a terrible day. Remember the Doug Williams game against the Denver Broncos extremely well, And I was in high school when Mark Rippon led what was arguably one of the greatest offenses in the history of the NFL, and is ranked as such when you see such rankings against the Buffalo Bills. I was going to say Super Bowl 22. I'm not sure. I always get my
I wasn't
numbers
there for it.
So I got some great memories. We call you, Chase. We call people your age here in DC. We call them the loss generation.
Oh, okay.
And there's a name for it. There's a whole generation of Redskins fans that have never seen them hoist a Lombardi trophy and have seldom seen them perform well enough, to get, you know, overly excited about it. It's happened here and there, but certainly nothing, on the national stage like, when I was a kid.
And it was just brutal because they had Robert Griffin. Like, that was the thing. I just remember being so excited and just like, oh, they gave up all this stuff. And it turned out it wasn't even like they gave up all that much, because the majority of those Rams picks that Les Snead made did not pan out, to say the least. And you do that for quarterbacks, like the Eagles did that for Carson Wentz, everybody else. But like, it just didn't work out. And then there was the weird stuff with Shanahan and everything else, and that's all gone. And they kept Jim Haslett around for like 25 years, which I never really understood, but it's fine. I want to start here because Washington, one of my favorite things about this team this year was that, I'm sure you're very familiar with this stat, is that every time they were basically with Alex Smith, when they got a lead, you knew they were winning the game. Like, they were undefeated. Almost, was it like week 10 or 11? They were undefeated when they were up at any point in the game, and they had lost every single game that they fell behind in. So it's a very Alex Smithian stat, but I want to start there. Did this team finish about where they should be, or was this team, if Alex Smith does not go down and just and that awful injury, are they playing in Los Angeles this past weekend?
Well, it's not just Alex Smith. I mean, I think from a Vegas perspective, ahead of the season, the 7 wins was pretty much the market.
Yeah.
So if you, the national gambling, because gambling, you know, Chase, is a thing now, right? I mean, we can actually, it's a barometer of, I always would refer to it in the past because I believe in it. But Vegas and the Goodfellas who make the lines, they know what they're doing for the most part. The money moves. There's an interesting, and I'll circle back to your question, but the cool thing about, as far as the national perception of the Redskins, because I feel like that was part of your question, is just where they should have finished. The national perception of the Redskins has always been so crappy, for obvious reasons. When they've been on primetime, they've stunk, and they've stunk bad. The storylines that have surrounded Dan Snyder and his tenure have been bad. And they've permeated through all the nooks and crannies of the NFL's, you know, national fandom. So what the interesting thing from a gambling perspective is that, by and large, the Redskins have done well against the spread, and they've done well for gamblers because of that, because so much money lines up against the Redskins because of what the average person thinks of them, that the gambling community has actually come around on the Redskins, because it's actually been, up until now, a pretty good bet, because so many people are willing to bet against them. I think that the 7 wins is probably about where the market was for them. And Alex Smith getting hurt crushed them. But you have to remember, the Darius Geis injury cannot be overstated. He's a transcendent talent. Certainly, you don't put resources into a running back. We haven't here in Washington, and a lot of teams kind of stopped. Only a handful of running backs have really been drafted high, and he kind of fell to us in the second round. And a second round draft pick is a valuable resource for a running back in this day and age, especially for the Redskins. He's fast, he's violent, he can catch. He showed you just a flash of it in the preseason before he got hurt. He would have made the offense look different. Him and Alex Smith, I think, would have been a healthy Alex Smith and a healthy Darius Geis. We're probably worth another win and a half, another 2 wins. And I think if that's true, you're at least talking about a team that's contending for the NFC at the end.
Yeah. And I mean, it just happened so early on that we forgot all about it. And they kind of reinvented themselves, which I think they deserve credit for with Adrian Peterson, is that was just a different team. They were not planning to start the season that way. They were planning on utilizing a very forward-thinking style in that they were going to have Alex Smith in the shotgun do a bunch of cool RPOs because they had Chris Thompson and Darius Geis. They had these two weapons that if they put them on the field together, it's a terrifying thing where you could see some Chiefs-like stuff. Like, obviously not as crazy with Patrick Mahomes, but like with the personnel they have around him, you could tell that if the offensive line stayed healthy, which they got decimated by injuries, they just got decimated by injuries everywhere, which cannot also be understated. It's not just Darius Geis. This team just got destroyed all across the offensive line. I remember in the Falcons game, you were down to what, like four total available guys, and you were going to have to eventually get, I don't even remember who it was who was going to have to play. Was it a tight end?
I know. It was a defensive tackle.
Right.
Who was going to have to come in and play.
Okay.
But I mean, second straight season, 20 starters on IR. The total for injured reserve for the Redskins this year, I believe, was 24.
Does that fall on Jake Gruden, or is it just an unlucky kind of situation there?
I think I don't hang it on Jake Gruden. I know people do around here.
The reason I ask is because Michael Lombardi in his NFL piece last week mentioned this, is that like he has to do something about his offseason program, and that's the reason or his reason as to why this team is getting decimated by injuries year after year. And I don't know if that's true or fair. I just thought it was interesting that I just think it's weird to put that on the head coach. Like, I just feel like sometimes I would subscribe more to the belief that it's just the front office picking players who are more injury prone than others. That might be more of it than whatever the coaching staff's doing. Cause I feel like a lot of guys are just born with that kind of issue and some aren't. Like, there's just some guys who can take a lot of hits and that just for whatever reason, they're fine year after year. And then others are kind of made of glass. And sorry to bring up Robert Griffin III again, but he's someone who comes to mind there. But I don't know. It's weird. And it's got to be super frustrating if you're Washington. And that was like my biggest thing about this team, is that like the 7-win mark seemed right because they have too much talent to be bad. And I've always thought that. And I think if you look up and down that coaching staff and everything else, you're like, this team, especially in a weak NFC East this year, like there's just no reason this team cannot win it, especially with a quarterback like Alex Smith, who one of my favorite things to talk about on this podcast, shout out to PFF Austin Gale, is that dude just wins regular season games. If you look up the last couple of years, it's what this guy does. He just wins games he's supposed to and loses games that he's supposed to. And in a winnable NFC East, like I had them winning the division before the year because I wasn't a big believer in Philly doing back-to-back stuff. I wasn't a Cowboys guy, and obviously the Giants just still a lot of work to do. So I was like, the Redskins just make a lot of sense to me. And then injuries happen and Darius Geis goes down and I will never quit Josh Dotson, and Vernon Davis is just a unicorn who refuses to fall apart, and Jordan Reed will never be what we want him to be, and Jameson Crowder got hurt, and you go up and down the list and you're like, God, if they could just have all these guys, if you could just, if the Redskins were like Madden where you could just turn injuries off, this is a 10-win team, I feel like. And that's something that we have to talk about when you're looking at this roster and this team and where they can go. I don't think they have the upside of the Rams or the Saints, obviously, but I do think that they have the upside of the Cowboys, the Panthers, the Falcons, the Bears, the Vikings. They're in that category where until they get the offensive firepower or the necessary quarterback who will push them there, I don't think they'll be in that class, but I think they're a solid A-, B-plus when they're completely healthy. And I don't think that's an outlandish take.
No, it's not. The problem is for the so as far as the injury stuff, I mean, I'm not going to hang it on Jay, but I think from an organizational standpoint, Bruce Allen's just a dumpster fire, of a team president. And I think he needs to go, but we can get to that. But 10 wins, the thing that the Redskins have had going when they were moderately healthy is a fairly stout defensive line. You know, they started out the season being good against the run. To your point, their style was time of possession, ground and pound, and Tress Way, the punter. Here's a guy who didn't have a single touchback all year. All he did was make the other team start from inside the 20 every single time, and gave our defense a chance to get stops, and they did early on. And I think they had injuries as well on the defensive side. The thing that sucks a little bit for my anti Bruce Allen, anti Dan Snyder is you come back next season, you still have a lot of young talent on defense. You still have an offensive line that'll start the season healthy with a running back in Darius Geis that's presumably going to be spending the offseason training with Adrian Peterson, So that sounds awesome. You have Jay Gruden coming back as head coach, which is, this is by far the most stability on the sideline we've ever had under Dan Snyder. And Doug Williams in the front office and his guys, maybe they make some right picks on offense, which is where we need something. And all of a sudden, you know, it is a 10-win team or a 10-win possible team. And the thing about it is, if you get that team into the playoffs, no, they don't have the upside of Patrick Mahomes' offense or Sean McVay's offense. But in the playoffs, it's not that you don't need that. In the playoffs, you can roll with your defense in a ground game and try to make the other team make a mistake.
You just need to play at home, teams, basically. Like, if you're a home team, like the Cowboys are a totally different team on the road versus at home, where it's like, if they play the Rams at home, they could win that game and play the way they want to play with Zeke and everything else. But, if Washington went 12-4 and murdered everybody in the regular season and got to host everybody in the NFC, you could see a path, kind of like what you're talking about, where the ground and pound, the defense first stuff.
We have no home field advantage, Chase.
No.
It's the most ridiculous situation. Our stadium is terrible.
It's a reputable advantage, winning. But you can't overlook the fact that home teams are just, especially over the last 5 years, are destroying everybody. Like, we are now another Final Four of number one, number two, number one, number two. Like, that's just, there is something to just having home field advantage. Like, the Pats have had home field, they've had a bye, eight or nine times in their nine Super Bowl runs? Like, there's just value in hosting playoff games. Like, there's just something there where there's been studies where it's like those guys, home teams generally speaking, get better calls, and that's part of it. But it's just playing at home. If you're an NFL fan, you want number one seed, or you're just like the whole stuff of like, oh, can Nick Foles do it again? It's like, no, Nick Foles, the first time they were the number one seed, he got to play at home the whole time. Like, that matters. And him just asking him to go a backup to go on the road and run the table again, it's not realistic. So I don't know.
Way better on the coaching.
Yeah,
they were. They were better on the road. If you're asking me,
so were the Chargers, and they just got beat by like 45 points.
That's fine. As a Redskins fan, I want my team on the road.
Interesting.
Trust me,
you're trying to buck the trend. Yeah. You're like, no, we don't need it.
Nope. Okay. I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me. But I want my boys sleeping in a hotel somewhere else. And waking up and not having to go to Landover. When we get the new stadium in D.C., Chase, maybe something changes. Maybe a different feeling happens. In the next 6-7 years, I think the FedEx Field's out in 2027. We're going to get an announcement. We're going to start seeing some ground, digging, some kind of groundbreaking. It's going to happen in the next 1 or 2 years. We'll get an announcement and a plan. When they put the team back in the city, which I think that's what's going to happen, then I'll be willing to entertain the idea that the Redskins can enjoy some true home field advantage. I've been going to FedEx for 20 years. I've been there.
Are
they even when
as
the Redskins
bad as people
terrible.
Talk about them? I feel like I remember seeing pictures of them being super tight. Is that true?
What's that? Say it again.
The seats being like super tight, like they're really small seats and they kind of squish everybody in. Is that what the biggest complaint is?
I've been around too. I've been around to a lot of stadiums. I don't think that's an issue. The problem with Redskins is what Dan Snyder's done over the years. Even when they were terrible when he first came, and we were 8-8 and 7-9, and Schottenheimer had a kind of a average year, their stadium was packed.
And he only got like 1 year, right? Didn't he get fired after one?
Well, he quit.
Or quit?
He,
yeah.
He was only here for
God. That's
because Dan Snyder wouldn't stay away from Vinny Serrato.
Oh my God.
And Schottenheimer said mirror him, and Snyder chose Vinny Serrato.
Wow.
But what's happened is the season ticket holders have not renewed. The place has shrunk. It started out at 93,000 seats. He's taken out at least 10,000, 11,000, 12,000 seats. What happened in an intermediate period, like 5, 6, 7 years ago, he sold huge blocks of tickets, 5,000 and 10,000 seat blocks to ticket brokers. And it started this whole trend of Washington becoming kind of like some of these other cities, a destination experience. People were flying in to watch their team play. We're seeing that play out in a lot of cities, not just Washington. FedEx is absolutely going through that right now. I've been going for 20 years. The last 2 or 3 years, the Redskins fans have not been a majority, you know, maybe 50%, 60% on a great day of the fans in the stands. Snyder's just ruined it.
Man. Well, maybe he'll sell. You never know. Maybe he'll sell. Like, James Dolan is doling out hope every now and then that he might sell, and he knows the price that he's going to pay. So you saw that ESPN piece. Maybe Dan Snyder finally gets sick of it. You never know. And then Bruce Allen can become the permanent vice president, whatever his title is, for the next 50 years.
No!
Just for you.
Oh, God, Chase. That would be my nightmare.
It had to suck for you to see, like, the John Gruden stuff open up where it was like, oh, he can reunite with the other Gruden. He can go to Oakland. That would make so much sense. This is it. And you see the reports a little bit, like, popping up on Pro Football Focus or Pro Football Talk, excuse me, and being like, oh, Bruce Allen might go back and join John. And then he hires Mike Mayock. And then you're like, oh, God, we're stuck with this guy. Like, this is, he's not going anywhere.
Nope.
Yeah.
And not only is he not going anywhere, he's motion.
I mean, how could you not after his recent... I mean, hey, he's drafting a lot of Alabama defensive linemen that are working now. That's nice, I guess. Darius Geis, good for him. There's a little bit... I still love Josh Dotson. That's fine. I don't know.
What
it could be worse.
What do you love most about Josh Dotson?
I love that he is still like a huge playmaker type. I still just see it. I remember the highlights at TCU and everything where you're like, this dude has great. This guy should be today's NFL like that. He should be like T.Y. Hilton. He should be somebody like that where you're terrified of anyone throwing at him. You're terrified of going 25 yards downfield and seeing what he can do. Because he has good hands. He's had some good catches in the back of the end zone that you've seen. And I don't know. It's just there are some little things where I'm just like, if that dude could ever stay healthy and put it all together, I still believe that he was worth the first round pick and is someone who could be a really good player in this league.
He's got another year.
Yeah, I won't do it. He's not Laquon Treadwell or something. I think there's still time.
He's got a rookie contract still, so he's not costing us a ton of money. He's got another year to prove that he can play ball, but he is not. I mean, he's been hurt, but
his main problem. He just can't stay healthy. He's like made of glass. He's another one. I'm going to throw three quarterback names at you, and I want you to rank them in terms of most likely, in your opinion, to be Washington quarterbacks. You ready?
Yep.
Nick Foles, Teddy Bridgewater, Ryan Tannehill, because I think one of these three will be the starting quarterback week one in Washington this fall.
No Blake Bortles?
No. Blake Bortles is... No. No. There's no way they're that bad. This is not that like this franchise gave up a lot for Alex Smith for stability and because he's actually a good quarterback, just not a great one. Blake Bortles is not a good quarterback. He's a really, really shitty quarterback, and they're not going to do that. There's no way. I do not like. Dude, you have to fire everybody in the Blake building Bortles. On the spot if Blake Bortles is brought in as your temporary Alex Smith replacement. That is just that. Oh God, this is going to get me heated for Washington fans. No,
your lifetime. Not as a Redskins fan, but your lifetime, the Washington Redskins have built themselves around Blake Bortles. The list is unbelievable.
Like Rex Grossman?
Blake Bortles. Yeah, like Rex Grossman. I mean, there's like 15 of them. You're talking Tony Banks territory, Jeff George. We can go through all the way down the list, the Patrick Ramseys of the world, the Todd Collins, the John Freezes, and Kent Grahams. And,
Collins.
Forget about
him. Oh, my God.
Blake Bortles fit in so well, but let's not go there. Let me answer your question.
Yeah.
So, Hill, Foles, and Bridgewater. I most prefer Bridgewater over
those
three.
That's what I would prefer. I think it's a huge win if they get Bridgewater. I think that's like the perfect option for them. That's what I hope. I don't think that's who it's going to be, but I would hope it's Bridgewater.
I don't think... I think you're missing the one thing that... I don't think we can afford any of those three. Honestly.
I don't know. Bridgewater is the most affordable of the three, right? It's not like he like blew the doors off the Panthers in that final game. Like Kyle Moore out, or whatever his name is, Kyle Allen outplayed him in week 17. Like it wasn't like Bridgewater blew the doors off everything. Like I don't think he's going to command a long-term deal or anything like that. I would expect another one-year prove-it deal for him.
Even on 1 year. Even a guy like him is still getting somewhere between $18 and $20 million.
You think so?
Dan Bradford got a 2-year, like $40 million deal guaranteed.
Shit, he might. I mean, I don't know. They can make it happen. They're going to do something. They cannot go into next year with Colt McCoy as their starter in week one. There's no way.
But and the problem is Alex Smith, we owe him $51 million still, guaranteed. No matter what happens, he gets $51 million.
To be fair, you would need to pay me $51 million to be the Washington Redskins quarterback in guarantees.
There you go.
It's part of doing business with Dan Snyder.
I want to say he's on the books for like $3 million next year. You know, he's a godsend. That's a contract he can actually outplay.
Oh, God. I'm going to guess Nick Foles. That's who I think it's going to be. I think Nick Foles.
But if I'm not affording him, he's going to get $20 plus million.
I know. And it's going to be Nick Foles. I need you to brace yourself that Nick Foles is your week one starter. If I was the Redskins, that's what I would do. I would sign Teddy Bridgewater, and then I would draft a quarterback in the first round. They need to take multiple shots, because what they did down the stretch last year with Colt McCoy and Josh Johnson was indefensible with the amount of talent they had, and they were going for an NFC East title still. Like, that shit cannot happen again, and I'm all about quarterbacks, and we know Washington is not scared of taking two quarterbacks instead of just rolling with one at a time. Like, I would do that. I would just keep throwing shit at the wall if I'm Washington, because I don't think Alex Smith is the long-term answer. I don't think Colt is. I don't think Teddy Bridgewater would be. Just get as many guys in the room. I think that's a positive. Like, look at Jacoby Brissett and Andrew Luck, and you see what Nick Foles has done with Nate Sudfeld and Carson Wentz. I think there is something to just having multiple guys you can count on. Like, obviously there is a pecking order, but I would draft one in the first round, and I'd also sign Teddy Bridgewater if I'm Bruce Allen, legendary executive of the Washington Redskins.
We had Kevin Hogan, the youngster out of Stanford, and he would have been our third quarterback. They decided to be super smart and not carry three. And Kevin Hogan's played in the league. He was snapped up quickly by Denver off of our, when we made that decision. And God, I mean, Kevin Hogan would have been an upgrade for us over what we saw at the end of the season. And Josh Johnson, he gave us a lot. I'm proud of what he was able to do. But if Kevin Hogan had been here all year long and stepped into the spot, you know, with 2 or 3 weeks to go in the season, I'm pretty confident it would have been a different result.
Kevin Hogan?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God.
Dude, did you see our team at the end? I'm not talking like Aaron Rodgers.
Kevin Hogan?
Yes.
Oh,
absolutely.
No. Oh, wait,
versus Kevin Hogan versus a 32-year-old Josh Johnson who's played for 13 teams in the league.
How about just calling Kaepernick?
I would have called Kaepernick.
Yeah.
I would have brought him in. Yeah. Absolutely, I would have. I would have called Tebow. I would have called a lot of people.
Do you know what I would have done? Brought back RG3. Leave the memories alone. He was doing nothing in Baltimore. Just why not?
Unavailable.
Not available. But you see, another team doing that, where they just load the QB room. I think that's what you do. That's what their offseason goal should be.
Well, we're going to load it up. We're talking dollar store now, Chase. Mm. We have like $25 million in total cap space. Now, they'll clear a little bit more, but they still got to get at a wide receiver. They still probably are looking for a tight end. They're going to pay some for second and third round draft picks. They got to find a safety. They got to pay a safety. They don't come cheap. We're probably adding a quarterback that's not going to be in that $18 to $20 million range. So we're going to let guys have to make some
because all of them are leaving because they're tired of the circus. Shout out to Bill Callahan and Tom Sula.
Yep.
Man, Tom Sula would be a gigantic blow. I'm not sure Bill Callahan would be, but Tom Sula, man, especially with Jonathan Allen, how much they've invested in just draft capital in that defensive line. Oof, that'd be brutal.
Well, he's gone.
Oh, is that official? I mean, I know his contract was up, but I mean, he could still return. I thought he could still come back because Callahan's still under contract. I thought Tom Sula could still come back because he doesn't have another job yet.
We don't know anything, but the team's being very tight-lipped. But the word I keep hearing is that these guys are just, you know, working for Bruce Allen is not very gratifying.
So it's not a Jay Gruden thing. It's a Bruce Allen thing.
Correct.
Hmm. Interesting. Damn.
Bruce Allen was voted as the least trustworthy NFL executive last year by a poll of players and agents and league folks. He was the number one least trustworthy NFL decision maker in this poll. And not only was he not fired, not only was he not removed from dealing with other teams, he was promoted. And Sally Jenkins for the Washington Post, who I believe when she reports stuff, she's been around forever, 20 years. She's quoting league, you know, the league office folks as them calling Bruce Allen a joke. I mean, this is our team.
Oh God, I tried not to end this podcast on this kind of note, man. So sour. But
you don't have to. Dallas and Philadelphia lost this weekend. I take a lot of pleasure in that. A ton of pleasure. Maybe more than I should. But it was happy time for Ken over the weekend.
Okay. Give me a off-season to-do list. Give me a three-part. You gave me the names. What are you looking for to make this a successful off-season?
I've got to have a starting safety.
Okay. Not DJ Swearinger.
It won't be DJ Swearinger. Mm-hmm. No.
And is I don't Josh know Norman back?
I would trade Josh Norman.
Okay.
He's got 2 years left on his contract for about $11.5-12 million each year. He's a good player. He had a good year. He was not our problem. He is not the reason we're bad. I just I always say this: if you're going to be the guy who wants to suggest trade, you have to be willing to trade something of value to get something of value. And I think Josh Norman has value. I think he's going to start on plenty of teams in this league. I don't think it's prohibitive. I think the Redskins can get something back for him. We have some young corners. I would say we would draft another corner in the first three rounds and get something, you know, maybe a wide receiver.
Are we sure they just don't need to be healthy at the wide receiver spot? Other than, like, I would probably go quarterback, offensive lineman, corner if I was Washington the first three rounds.
See, I'm not sold on quarterback in the first three rounds only because I want to hear, you know, definitively that Alex Smith was never playing football again. Because those words haven't been said. He is trying to come back. We do owe him $51 million. If he can play, I would like to see him try to play next season. It solves a lot of problems for us, not the least of which is having a professional at quarterback, not the least of which is not causing us to accelerate $51 million of dead, you know, salary cap up until 2019. And it allows us to go one more year without drafting a quarterback, because in my first three rounds, I'm going offensive lineman, defensive back, whether it be safety or cornerback, and wide receiver.
Okay. All right. That's fair. This has been great. I really appreciate it, Ken. We'll have to do this again soon under better circumstances, when Bruce Allen is gone, or when you sign Teddy Bridgewater, or when Josh Dotson becomes the all-pro that I've always believed him capable of being. There's all kinds of options here. But either way, I really do appreciate you taking the time, and we can read you at hogshaven.com, the best Washington Redskins blog on the internet. Ken, this has been great. I really do appreciate it, sir.
Hey, Chase, also, if you wouldn't mind if I could plug First Amendment Sports.
Yes, you can.
We cover all DC sports. I was going to say, if you ever want to talk Nats, Caps, Wizards, the Maryland Terrapins, or if you even want to talk about the greatest high school sports conference in the entire country, we cover it, and we could save that conversation for another time. You could say, what are you talking about? That's impossible. It's not impossible. It's an amazing sports town if you can get past the latest Redskins stories. You know, we're watching the Harper sweepstakes. We're watching our Caps go through a little bit of a Stanley Cup hangover in the middle of the season. Wizards are pretty much sucking out loud.
No, but it's Miles Satoransky is back in the starting lineup. He's averaging almost a triple-double again.
You know,
my dude is back. The Wizards are making the playoffs, and I need you to prepare yourself because that's happening.
I've been saying it loud, Chase, and no one will believe me. They are absolutely making the playoffs.
People are out of their mind if they don't think that team's making the playoffs. Bradley Beal and Tomas Satoransky have a natural chemistry, and they're bringing Otto Porter off the bench and everything. Once they get... Oh, God, yeah. No, the Wizards are making the playoffs. I'm not even worried about it. But we can talk about all that. Just hit me up, man.
Yep, awesome. And I love your Satoransky love. It's long needed.
This is a very pro Satoransky podcast. And I was very upset when Ty Lawson was in the rotation in the playoffs last year over him. It was baffling and just fucking absurd. But anyway, we can talk about all that another time. Ken, I really do appreciate it. And we will talk again soon.
Thanks a lot, Chase.
All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas podcast, and I am now joined by the best name in baseball writing, Wick Terrell. Wick, good evening. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
What a name. I just, Wick A, like, I'm sure just with John Wick coming out in the last couple of years, that's come back in style, and just when people hear your first name, they're like, there's no way that's your actual first name.
That's quite true. Yeah, actually, it's a movie I'm quite a big fan of. I appreciate that it came out. Okay. It's been pretty unique since day one. I've actually got the same name as my dad, so technically I'm Daniel, but I get to go by my middle name, so that makes it a little bit easier to discern who between my dad and I we're talking about. So
perfect. Well, I don't even go by either of my legal names, so it all works out. I know where you're coming from and just getting your own name, so that worked. But Wick, there is a lot we have to talk about tonight, because the Cincinnati Reds, who are a team that have won 60-something games for, I believe, let me check my notes, yes, 29 years straight. And it's just been annoying, because you're just like, oh, this rebuild's going, and it's just going. They made some front office shuffling a couple of years ago. It's just those years of them winning 90 a couple of years ago, I think it was like 2014 or something was the last time they did that, just feels like a lot longer. And that this rebuild's been going, but then you have some exciting young guys. You have Scooter Jeanette getting some MVP love last season. You have Homer Bailey no longer be on the roster, which is nice. Like, there's Matt Harvey was good for them in the second half. That was weird. So maybe pitchers aren't just doomed once they go to Cincinnati, but I just think it's interesting right now that we're seeing so many Reds news and rumors and them being active on the hot stove, because it's been very, very cool this offseason. But now we have Kluber stuff, Dallas Keuchel stuff. Like, are you at all surprised that the Cincinnati Reds are popping up all over the place this winter?
I'm not, honestly. It has been a long, 4 or 5 year slog now, where I guess technically speaking, during that 5 year window, they were very much connected in some big name rumors. They were just all selling rumors. It was getting rid of Jay Bruce and Johnny Cueto and Mike Leake and Matt Latos and you name it. You were up and down the roster, Rolls Chap, and it was a bunch of big name players. Bronson Arroyo as well. There was a bunch of guys they were getting rid of. And so it's finally nice for them to be connected again to a lot of these big name rumors, but also to have them be, connected with coming back to Cincinnati. And, they've made a couple big name acquisitions so far, obviously getting Yasiel Puig and Alex Wood and Matt Kemp, and shedding Homer Bailey's been great. Picking up Tanner Roark's been great as well. But they've got a lot of guys that are still kind of just only on 1 year deals. And so they've certainly made a lot of moves to where 2019 looks like it's going to be a lot more promising, significantly more promising than the last few years have been. But I'm still trying to wrap my head around exactly what their long-term goal is with all this, because there's a lot of guys that were all in their last year of team control or last year under contract. And while 2019 looks like it's going to be significantly better, here we are, in January, and in 9 months from now, they might just be right back in the same spot they were just a few months ago if they don't go out and get more players that are controlled longer. So I think they've started a great process. I'm excited to see where it goes from here. But I do still think there's a lot of unfinished business still left out there for them to do.
Where is Scooter Jeanette going?
That's a really good question. I think with the presence of Nick Senzel around, is pretty much consensus top 8, top 10 prospect overall, who's naturally a third baseman, but has played a lot at second base, and I think will be plenty fine there long term. With Scooter, I think the writing's kind of on the wall that they want Senzel to be a part of their infield. Jose Peraza is obviously still just in his first arbitration year. Eugenio Suarez signed a big contract extension. Joey Votto's not going anywhere, obviously. So Senzel's natural position is second base, if you kind of look to where the future's going. But with the second base market as deep as it is right now, guys like Brian Dozier and Josh Harrison and DJ LeMahieu, all settling for short-term contracts because there's so many second basemen out there. I don't think the Reds have found enough of a taker for Scooter to want to get rid of him at this point in time. So I think how he plays this year is going to, you know, go a long way, obviously, towards deciding whether or not the Reds want to keep him around. But he is a Cincinnati kid. They got him for basically nothing off of waivers from the Brewers. I think they're going to kind of ride having him around as long as they possibly can before they're forced to make a decision.
Can he play first base? Because if he can, they could do the Ian Desmond thing and push him to Colorado, and Colorado can test him out on that front. Because they can't get any worse production at first than what they've gotten in the last year.
That's certainly true. And, of course, they picked up Daniel Murphy also, another second baseman right. by trade that was on the market this year as well. I mean, the second base market, I think, had it been a lot more shallow this particular winter, there would have probably been a lot more rumors connected to Scooter because he's had a phenomenal two-year run. But there's so much about what he's had over those 2 years that just makes you question how much longer he can maintain it. And I think the idea of cashing in on him would probably be the wisest decision. Just from kind of an impartial fan take. But, I'm as intrigued as you are about what they're going to do with him because he's obviously played well enough to warrant being a valuable asset on the trade market out there if they want to do that. But also there's a lot of reasons why you might want to keep him around.
He was incredible last year. Like, he just, like, obviously the NL and AL MVP race was a little different, I would say, in that the top seven, I think, in the AL MVP voting were all better than the best NL MVP choice. Which is not good, I don't think, as a whole, but that's also why, like, Scooter, Yelich, and Freddie Freeman does not exactly match up to Aaron Judge, Mookie Betts, Jose Ramirez, and just you go up and down the list, you're like, oh, okay, there's a talent disparity in these two leagues, and obviously Alex Bregman, don't get mad at me, Astros fans, but yeah, so where do you think he ends up? Because I just, like you, I feel like that he's like the perfect guy to sell high on just because of the kind of year that he had. And you're like, okay, well, where can you send him? And like you said, there's just so much depth at the second base spot right now that no one really jumps out at you. And you kind of want to do right by him if you are going to move him. Like, the Yankees made sense to me before LeMahieu and Tulowitzki, where it was like that Sonny Gray for Scooter Jeanette rumor. That made a lot of sense on the surface, where you're like, I love the idea of the Reds just becoming the rehabilitation factory for New York pitchers who lost it in New York and then found their saving grace in Cincinnati, away from the spotlight. Like, that's a great American ballpark story, if I do say so myself. But I don't know. Like, that opportunity is obviously gone now, probably with Tulo and LeMahieu in the fold and Didi coming back whenever he does from that injury. And no one makes sense to me when you're going up and down the roster of like, well, you know what else doesn't help, Wick?
What's that?
A third of the league tanking. So the league does not want to win games. So why would they trade for Scooter Jeanette when they don't want to win baseball games?
You know, it's really,
that hurts.
It does, and it's really unfortunate. And it's actually, it mirrors a lot. Obviously, the way they came to the Reds is very, very different, but it mirrors a lot what happened last year, meaning 2017, when the Reds had Zach Cozart, who was a great shortstop, who came up as a glove-first shortstop. And then in the middle of the 2017 season where he was, you know, hitting OPS and in the 900s, setting career high marks and slugging percentage and home runs and everything else, and still playing his typical great defense, they couldn't find a taker for him. They just couldn't find a shortstop needy team out there anywhere because every good team had their shortstop in place. He'd never really played second or third base, despite the fact that he eventually signed with the Angels to play second and third base. Nobody wanted him to do that in that particular moment. And despite the fact he was, you know, an all-star and having a career season, the Reds couldn't find anywhere to send him. The Seattle Mariners were the only team that had any sort of connection to him, and even they balked at the eventual asking price. And the Reds ended up having to let him go in free agency because there was just nothing else they could do. The Scooter Jeanette scenario kind of mimics that, only for a little bit of a different reason in terms of like the buyer's market here. Whereas there were, you know, nobody needed shortstops and Cozart couldn't get moved in 2017. Everybody has options at second base now. And it seems like the idea of overpaying to get Scooter Jeanette, when you've got the options like LeMahieu and Daniel Murphy and Brian Dozier on the market as well, teams just haven't been willing to do that. And it's going to be really interesting to see where the Reds go with him going forward and whether or not he becomes one of those more intriguing bats that might be available at the trade deadline this year, should the Reds, despite their improvements, still not be in wild card contention.
Yeah, and part of the reason I was going to save this, but because you brought up the wild card contention stuff, the Reds are kind of screwed, and I feel bad because the NL Central is just, stacked. at the moment. And I don't really see an avenue for them to creep up and pass the Brewers or the Cubs. And then you have the Cardinals making big splashes by getting Paul Goldschmidt. You look at even the Pirates, who haven't done a full teardown. Like, the Pirates just traded for Chris Archer at the deadline last year. Like, they're still, like, in pseudo contention, which is what they've been in basically since they started contending again under this new administration with Hurdle and Hutchinson. And it's just going to be difficult. I mean, obviously things always change and teams just come out of nowhere and you're like, oh, how did this happen? Kind of like what the Rockies did last year, where I don't think any of us thought that they were going to be a playoff team, and they snuck in there, and the Mariners came out of nowhere, and that kind of stuff happens from time to time. But I just feel like they have a really tough road. I would feel a little bit better about them if they were in like the AL Central. Like, if they were in the AL Central, not the NL Central, would we be talking about this team depending on what they do? And this kind of ties into the Indian stuff of, like, are we sure that we didn't start like buying a lot of red stock just because, like, where they're going, where they're headed, they can win the AL Central for the next couple of years if the couple things hit home, these prospects hit the way they should, and they spend a little bit more money on their pitching, that, oh, you know what, they might have a team here that can compete and contend for the AL Central for the next couple of years. But no, they're in the NL Central. But at the same time, they're going after Corey Kluber and guys like that, Dallas Keuchel, depending on the years. Like, do you think that's something that's going to cloud a lot of people's perception of what this Reds team is, just because they're kind of blocked in a very difficult NL Central, when they're probably going to end up being a better team than their wins show this year?
You know, I certainly do. It kind of, for me, entering into this upcoming season, it's kind of got like almost a Toronto Blue Jays vibe to it, which is, even though the Blue Jays have been good and had really good players off and on for the last, you know, decade, more or less, guys like Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion and whatever, they had to work so incredibly hard just to make one playoff appearance. Because they've got the Red Sox, they've got the Yankees, they've got the perennial Rays doing whatever they do to maintain being competitive at a very low payroll. The Reds are up against it, and that's part of the reason why I'm so intrigued that they've gone out and gotten so many rental players, like the, you know, Puig Kemp, Rourke, Scooter Jeanette, David Hernandez, even in the bullpen, Alex Wood as well, because even if they are a much better team than they were in 2018, which I think they're going to be, you know, if they're not a breakout a winner through the first, you know, half of the season, more or less, suddenly they're faced with going to the trade deadline, potentially being even hovering around 500, but being 10, 12 games back, or being fourth place in their division. And then suddenly they've got six guys that they are going to have to try to find a way to trade. They're making close to $65 million this year, all of whom are in their last year under contract, none of whom really profile as potential qualifying offer guys, except maybe Yasiel Puig and maybe Scooter Jeanette if he's still playing as well as he has the last 2 years. And so going for that rental strategy while also being up against it against so many other better teams in the division just makes it's a really, really intriguing thing to me, because I think they've got a lot of tradable assets while they're also trying to win and impress their fans for the first time in several years. It's a really, really weird spot for them to be in. And I agree with you. I think they've got the ability to press and to make a much better impression in the win column they have over the last 4 years. But maybe that's just not good enough, because there are so many other better teams that are built to win in 2019 specifically in their division. And it's going to be really, really tough, because if they don't get off to that great start, they're going to have to change course very, very quickly.
Who do you have as more likely to be a starting pitcher for the Reds in 2019? Kluber or Dallas Keuchel?
That's a really, really good question. I think I want to say Dallas Keuchel, purely because I think the Reds are very reluctant to give up Nick Senzel for the same reason I mentioned. Scooter Jeanette's going into his last year under contract. They don't have a long-term second baseman really in-house right now. They've got Eugenio Suarez kind of embedded at third base on a great seven-year contract extension they signed him to prior to last year. But their second base options are pretty thin. You know, they let Dilson Herrera go because he was out of options and got claimed this past offseason. Alex Blandino is kind of a fringe starter, kind of utility infielder by trade anyway, and he's coming off a torn ACL. Shed Long is a good prospect, but is still yet to impress in Double A and might not be available for another 2 years at that, or at best. You know, Senzel pretty much is the natural transition there, and I think they're very reticent to get rid of him, purely because of the fit, but also because of how good he projects to be and how much money they spent on him as a number two overall draft pick. They've already got, you know, roughly $6 million they signed him for. They got a lot invested in him. be part of this team going forward. And I think they really want to hold on to him. And I'm not sure you can physically go get Corey Kluber with so many other teams out there thirsty for starting pitching without giving up one of those top prospects. And I think the Reds are going to be a little reluctant to do that, which makes me think that Dallas Keuchel's probably a more likely fit for them long-term, although I'm still really interested to see if they actually pull the trigger and make that deal happen.
Yeah, I don't buy the Kluber stuff. It just feels like, I think the Indians are going to keep Kluber and those guys. I think that just, it would just send such a bad message to that fan base to sell on Kluber when they're still in their pseudo AL contention window. Like, that's just a bad look. Like, Carlos Santana is one thing. Kluber is another one where it's just like he's maybe out, like, just he's the guy you think of outside of Andrew Miller, Jose Ramirez, and Francisco Lindor with this contention window. Like,
yeah, he is Cleveland. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. When they had the financial implications and the payroll stuff before they managed to kind of see that when Encarnacion and start making some of those moves to get their payroll down a little bit more, trading Yan Gomes as well, I thought it was something that was a little bit more realistic because I think they realized they could get a very, very good player for him. But at this point, I think they've done enough to kind of get that payroll down a bit, and they haven't been overwhelmed by an offer so far. I don't think they've got to trade him now. And I do think there are going to be some outfield options that are free agents that just kind of their market's not going to thoroughly develop, and they're going to be able to get
like Nick Markakis, Adam Jones, guys like that
I think will be good fits. And I think they're also kind of waiting on that market to see how healthy Bradley Zimmer is going to end up being as well. He's obviously a very good defensive center fielder. His bat should be better than what it has been so far. But I think they're kind of waiting to see how much more he can improve as they head towards spring training. Because they probably know there's going to be some decent free agent outfielders still left on that market that are almost kind of overlooked that they can probably go out and pick up. Or even, you know, we mentioned that second baseball market. If they want to put Jason Kipnis out in the outfield again like they have, they might be able to pick up, Asdrubal Cabrera late in the offseason as well and kind of make that happen for a much, much less impact to the roster than trading Corey Kluber because they feel like they have to.
Yeah. Kipnis, did you know he's still penciled in at the two spot if the season started today?
Jason Kipnis is one of the bigger enigmas in baseball because I feel like he doesn't look like he's hurt. He doesn't look like he's aged that badly. But
he's just not good.
He's just fallen off a cliff. I know. It's so weird to me because he was such a good player for so long. But he does.
They just let Michael Brantley go, who's really good. And Kipnis is going to be at the top of this order obviously it helps having guys like Ramirez and Lindor, but man.
It's so weird to see teams that have had such great success over the last few years make moves like this almost purely for financial decisions.
Right.
Look at it for the same reason that the Reds have Yasiel Puig and Matt Kemp and Alex Wood for two decent but not great prospects in Jeter Downs and Josiah Gray purely because the Dodgers just wanted to shed money. That was the only reason why they got rid of those guys. And obviously they've got great depth in Alex Verdugo and Cody Bellinger being able to play outfield and everything else going forward. But they basically just gave the Reds those players because they weren't going to sign them long-term and they had a number they were trying to get under. And it's so weird to see that be a much more prevalent thing in baseball now than it was even 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Well, it's great. Everybody loves it. Baseball's doing better than ever revenue-wise, and teams are not spending. It's great. It's great to be a veteran in today's baseball climate. It's a very good thing. You know that when you – I can't believe Kyler Murray wouldn't want to go down this avenue.
I know, right?
Who would ever foreseen? Yeah, who would ever want to do that? I just feel like it's going to be Keuchel. I'm with you. I think he's going to get like the four – I don't think he's going to get the fifth year that he's dying to get. I don't think any team's going to do it. The best case scenario is like a 4-year with the team option on the fifth or something like that. But
I think the Reds
just
are probably
feels like
I think the Reds are secretly like hoping they can Reds get him pitcher. For like that. I feel like they can. The Reds are trying to secretly get him on that Jake Arrieta contract where they can get him for three years, get him for $75 million, not guarantee more than that. And it's interesting with Scott Boras being in charge of Keuchel and Bryce Harper. You almost feel like he's in no hurry to tell Dallas Keuchel to sign anywhere because he's trying to figure out how many teams, quote unquote, have that $350 million to sign Bryce Harper. And whoever doesn't get him, that's who he's going to start calling about Dallas Keuchel and be like, hey, I know you've got the money to spend because you've been trying to spend it on one of my other clients. Pony up. And I think that's kind of what's holding the entire market up right now. And like you, I'm as anxious as possibly could be to find out where all these players are going to go, because there's so many good ones left out there. You know, beyond just the top end of the market, there's a lot of good mid-tier players that are out there just waiting to be signed, that are kind of just kind of holding their breath, hoping that something shakes and breaks soon. So they know where they're going, because I mean, spring training starts in what, a month?
Yeah, we're almost there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like 2021, me seeing on the bottom of the ticker that Dallas Keuchel is 9-17 with a 4.4 ERA for the Cincinnati Reds, who are just slogging their way in August. Like, that just seems right to me. That seems like a thing that's going to happen.
It does. It certainly does.
And I'm sorry.
No, I don't blame you whatsoever. I've been writing about the Reds pretty much since 2011, and luckily enough, I got in when there were still a few good seasons to write about. But I think the fact remains that, you know, the Reds have swung and missed on a lot of first round draft picks between their great. I mean, for a while, they had a phenomenal run of drafting. They got guys like Drew Stubbs, Devin Mesoraco, Zach Cozart, Homer Bailey, Jay Bruce, Joey Votto.
I love Drew Stubbs. I was a big Drew Stubbs guy. I love like little tall, lanky dudes who have ridiculous power for their size. Like he never made sense to me.
Until scouting reports realize that they can't hit curveballs, they're kind of the best players to watch in all of baseball.
But
I think the Reds have drafted much, much better over the last 3 or 4 years. It helps when you're picking number two overall, as opposed to picking, you know, 27th or 24th or whatever it was. But they had about a 6-year window where they really didn't draft well. And I think the one thing that's key for the Reds right now, and for a lot of teams in the middle or small into the market, you got to draft your players, you got to develop them well, and you got to hold on to them, despite the fact that you could trade them and go make big splashes for veteran players. And I think the front office for the Reds has realized that. They've been patient with it. And that's why they've got guys like Taylor Trammell and Nick Senzel, who are two top 20 overall prospects. The Reds in 2019, their strategy seems to be they've gone out and picked and plucked guys that are just one-year players to make them better right now, but they still don't seem like they're willing to leverage the future to go make a big splash in a trade, which is why I don't think Kluber's going to be an option, because they want to keep Senzel, they want to keep Taylor Trammell, and I think they still know that's the way back into total contention. But the fact of the matter is, they spent a little bit of money right now to make it more interesting in 2019, but they're going to have to do it again this time next year too to continue to kind of improve down the road. And I can't wait to see what the heck they do, because I agree with you. If they only go out and sign Dallas Keuchel and think that's going to be the long-term answer, 3 years from now, I think you'll see him with a bad record and the Reds with a bad record too.
I just wouldn't rule out Taylor Trammell to the Cubs for Kyle Schwarber and Yu Darvish. I think you need to keep that in the back of your mind. You never know.
You know, Kyle Schwarber, much like Scooter Jeanette, also a Cincinnati guy. And there are a lot of Reds fans that have been pining for Kyle Schwarber for a long, long time.
I was joking. Don't put this into the world. I don't want this to actually happen. Oh, my God.
You know, Yu Darvish. No. The thing is, Yu Darvish last year, Dallas Keuchel this year, you look at next winter's free agent class. And, you know, I mentioned that the Reds might have upwards of $65 million coming off the payroll with their one-year rental players. The pitching class for next year is probably as good as it's ever been. I mean, you got Garrett Cole, Chris Sale, Justin Verlander. Who else am I missing? Maybe Sonny Gray. If he bounces back and pitches like he did before last season, there's a lot of Madison Bumgarner too. There's just an incredible depth of good established pitchers next year that might be available. Maybe the Reds have a lot better interest in them, and that's why they're kind of biding their time and getting short-term guys now, because maybe they think that next year or this time next year is really the chance where they start pushing all their stuff in and going all in. And I'm interested to see, because we've only got, a month left between now and when pitchers and catchers report. If they don't sign Dallas Keuchel, maybe that means that they're channeling a lot more of their financial resources to this time next year to go get some of those guys to help build towards the future.
Or they're just trying to trade for JT Realmuto, but they can't get in touch with Derek Jeter. I don't know what the plan is.
Jeter's cell phone got lost in the home run statue when they moved it out of the building. Yeah.
He's still busy. He just turned his phone off after he got so many angry Marlins fans tweets about the new uniforms and
yeah.
The whole big announcement about all of that, and that just being what they came up with after all the hype.
He traded his cell phone to the Brewers along with Christian Yelich, right.
Do you buy it? I could see Realmuto on the Reds. It's not a crazy thing.
It's not, you know, and of all the teams that have been connected with him, I think the Reds are definitely hesitant to give up those top prospects, like I mentioned. But if the Marlins are looking to get a good catcher back in return as part of that return, Tucker Barnhart on his contract is pretty much, if they're looking for a combination of existing catcher and prospects plus, I think Tucker mm-hmm. Barnhart's the best fill-in at catcher that they could possibly get for Real Muto among the teams that were initially connected with him. I mean, Barnhart's contract, he's due, what, like $16 million over the next 3 years. Gold Glover in 2017.
Which is music to Derek Jeter's ears.
It is.
What does he care? I mean, hey, that's more money in his pocket, right?
And
that's
exactly
what we all want as baseball fans. Those owners making that money back on stripping the team to nothing and getting the Yankees to pay a little bit more of that salary for Giancarlo Stanton and everything else. That's what fans really love, when he can sweeten the pot like that, where the other team pays more of the salary than the old team. It's great stuff. I love it. Sports are healthy and great, and things are fine.
$10.3 billion in revenue, and it's also the smallest amount of revenue that players have ever had in modern baseball history. So, no, I agree with you. It's one of those things where I think teams have realized that they've kind of got the upper hand in terms of how salaries are put together. And, you know, the younger players are better now than they ever have been. The pre-free agent players are better than they ever have been. And nobody really wants to pay 32, 33, 34-year-old players the way that they have in times past. And I do believe it's heading towards a little bit of an impasse. How quickly they can resolve it, and whether or not it results in a strike or just simply a renegotiated CBA, I don't know. But I agree with you. It's one of those things when you look up and teams crying foul and saying that they don't have enough money and just waiting out the free agent market the way they have, it doesn't do anything to endear themselves to fans. That's for damn sure.
Oh, man. Just brutal. I was hoping we would go a little bit more positive with this good stuff, but this is how we can end
it. It's hard to be super positive for 20 minutes, right?
Well, I mean, you have David Bell as the new manager. His grandfather played for the Reds. It's a nice little heartwarming story, kind of.
Yeah, you know, he was a manager for AAA for the Reds for a couple of years as well, and was actually one of the candidates for the job when Dusty Baker got hired 10, 11 years ago, and ended up not getting much consideration because he obviously didn't have managerial experience then, but has gone on to have a phenomenally successful managerial career, got front office experience. And that is one aspect about this Reds offseason that I'm really excited about, is that they hired a guy who was getting legitimate consideration to be the general manager of the San Francisco Giants. And for a team that has had as much success as they have, as the Giants have, to be considering a guy like that for a job upstairs, much less in the dugout, and for the Reds to get him in the dugout, I think is really kind of a coup. And, it's a bold strategy to go from Brian Price, who had no managerial experience and flamed out miserably despite the front offices giving him nothing to work with, going to a second consecutive rookie manager who has no managerial experience. It's bold. You know, there were a lot of people that wanted a guy like Joe Girardi, who had experience and a resume that was through the roof and whatever. The Reds were patient enough to not do that. And how that pans out is another big question mark going forward in the next couple of years. But if anybody I think has got the talent and wherewithal to pull it off, I think it's David Bell. And I really, really do like the decision to hire him.
Well, I've always said that if there was ever going to be a new Sparky Anderson, it was David Bell. No one else fits the mold quite like David Bell. I've always said young Sparky is
young
what I believe they called him growing up.
I'll take it. I would gladly accept that. No doubt.
It's my favorite baseball name of all time. I remember as a kid seeing that name come up when I'm just going through sports encyclopedias. I'm like, Sparky Anderson, is this a real thing? Is this a thing? He's the all-time wins leader in Reds history and everything else. And you're like, what the hell? This is incredible. And then you realize that Jack McKeon was a really good Reds manager for a little bit and all this other stuff. And you're like, a lot of cool stuff here. Reds had some cool stuff.
Sparky Anderson might be behind Bubbles Hargrave and High Pockets Kelly. It might be Sparky Anderson. But that's a pretty Hall of Fame elite of all-time names in baseball history. That's for sure.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, we can read you on redreporter.com. Is there anything that's coming out this week that we should check out from you?
So we're working our community prospect rankings right now, which for the first time, well, maybe last year was probably the first real time, but the Reds actually have a really, really good, really, really deep farm system right now, since they haven't gone out and traded for a Corey Kluber yet. But we're doing our community prospect rankings every single day, probably now for the next 3 weeks. We rank our top 25 overall prospects. That's out every single morning. We're doing updates to our proprietary top players in Cincinnati Reds history. And we'll have updates on all the current players as well, going through that. And then we're just kind of holding our breath, waiting for those next big Reds moves, which we do expect to happen between now and spring training, at least one or two more. But yeah, we've got a lot of that going on, and we'll have Red reports on all of the existing players coming forward too. And it's our busy season. It's the funnest season for me personally, because I love the offseason and transactions and all the above. And I'm excited to see that the Reds are actually on the buying side of things going forward.
And you don't have to think about how much money Homer Bailey is making this season.
I don't have to ever write another Homer Bailey article ever again, which is kind of intriguing to me too, because God, for as promising as he was for so long, the last 3 years have just been brutal trying to follow him.
Yeah. Oh, well. And Billy Hamilton, another guy who you were just waiting on, but it just never happened. The offense never came together. But now he's off to bigger and better things in Kansas City, where the rebuild looks short and things are going to be great there really soon. Oh, no, he's in.
You know, you don't have to look too much further for why the Reds have not been successful over the last few years. You list Homer Bailey, you list Billy Hamilton, you list Devin Mesoraco. They've had a lot of guys they put a lot of faith in that just didn't quite pan out. And they're at least to the point where they've moved on from those. And that's not to say that the next crop of players is going to pan out better than they did. But at least they don't have guys that haven't panned out that are currently on the roster. And at least that gives Reds fans a little bit more hope than they've had in the last few years.
Progress. That's all we're looking for in Cincinnati these days. And Hugh Jackson, not the coach of the Bengals. So things are looking up in Cincinnati. Who day and everything else. Wick, I appreciate it. And we will have to talk again soon, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope the Reds continue to make some newsworthy moves.
There you go. That's all you can hope for. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas podcast, and I am now joined by someone who has been suffering for the last couple of years of watching one of the greatest hockey players of my generation get put on a team that's just, it's not great in Edmonton, but it's a guy who watches a lot of Connor McDavid. It's Rob Soria of The Hockey Writer. Rob, good evening. How are you?
Well, probably a little better than you might think I'm doing after hearing that intro.
I'm sorry, man. Like, I was going back through the records and just the numbers since Kevin Lowe left, and it's not good. And I feel like I've seen this story before in so many different sports where it's like team stumbles into just transcendent talent because the current GM, who we'll talk about in a second, drafted him as a no-brainer. Connor McDavid was one of those rare no-brainers like Sidney Crosby and other guys like that. And the problem is the GM in the front office and ownership group has no idea actually how to build that team around the superstar and make sure that they become the Maple Leafs or the Tampa Bay Lightning or Nashville Predators or Winnipeg Jets or whoever. It's gone the other way. This is a 500 team. They have a superstar in Connor McDavid, and that's about it. I just feel like this is more frustrating than just being bad, because they can't even like get bad enough where they can surround McDavid with more superstars and try to help him get out of this purgatory in the NHL. Am I overstating the state of Edmonton Oilers hockey right now?
A little bit, but not a lot, to be quite honest with you, because there are some other pieces still in tow that are really good players. The problem is, as you mentioned, the way the team was constructed, they panicked at the wrong time, and now it's cost them, because they did have a lot of pieces in place for suffering through their rebuild that they started, shall we say, back in 2010. And they had pieces in place. The problem is, the first year
all those guys are gone.
That's the problem, right? That's when they panicked. That first year was the issue. They had an off year, and that off year, to be honest with you, was very much dealt with injuries. And again, the roster still wasn't set. And then they panicked, made a couple of moves, and yeah, they had a really good year and 16, 17. But now you're starting to see the issue, as you mentioned. Even if you got a couple of three good players, and hockey's even more so than most sports, you can't win with just a couple of guys. You need to have depth. You can win with a couple of superstars, but you need depth elsewhere in the roster. And unfortunately, the current general manager had some knee-jerk reactions a couple of years ago, and now it's costing them.
Do you think it was an ownership thing? Because we see that a lot too, where like ownership realizes they have the superstar and they want to expedite the process of building a winner. And they were just like, no, we need to win now. We need to invest a lot of money because there is so much salary already invested in this team over the next 10 years, basically. It's like 2025 feels like 10 years from now, but it's not. But just looking at the amount of money that is already in this team that's just playing 500 hockey, it's staggering. And you just, I don't know, it kind of reminds me of the Red Wings in a way, the Blackhawks, other teams like that, where there's just so much money invested in a team that's just not going to compete for the cup because they just, like you said, they don't have the depth and everything else. So does it all fall on the GM? Because they already have done the cliche thing of firing the coach, like, so he's gone, and the GM is now, there's a bunch of questions whether or not he's going to stick around through the remainder of the season. But also, you don't want him making moves at the deadline if he's not your guy going forward, because ultimately you want someone new in there before he starts making other franchise-altering decisions. What do you make of the current coach and GM dynamic in Edmonton?
Well, back to the original point that you made with regards to ownership, it's a little different here because Daryl Gates, who runs the team here, he grew up here and it was a really big Oilers fan through the dynasty years. He's buddies with all those guys. So I think part of the play, as you mentioned earlier, to get better quick, I think part of the issue was, yeah, you saw you got this transcending player that you've got in your lineup now, and you're looking at an organization that went years without making the playoffs. So, yeah, I think they kind of jumped the gun a little bit. And now it's, like we mentioned, it's put them in this situation. And as far as the coach and GM goes, well, from a coaching standpoint, honestly, I'm pretty sure Ken Hitchcock is probably just a fill-in for the remainder of the year. His track record speaks for itself. He's been a very successful coach in the NHL, has been for ages. He's going to end up in the Hall of Fame. He's also a guy who wears out his welcome in short periods of time in spots, especially these days as athletes in every sport are different, and that hard love act wears thin. And it brings us to Peter Chiarelli. And as far as Chiarelli goes, he didn't inherit, some of what he inherited wasn't great from a standpoint of what the Oilers had brewing in the farm system. So I do give him that, and he has improved that, and you'll see a little bit of that hopefully coming forward. But what he did inherit was elite young talent. And unfortunately, outside of a couple of guys, he's literally gave it away and got pennies on the dollar. So because of that, it's left this team where it is. He's made some poor decisions from a free agent standpoint. He's incapable of winning a trade that involves real, genuine, high-end NHL talent. In my opinion, he should have been gone last year. But there's no way on God's green earth I can see him lasting to next season. My guess is he will last the season because, honestly, more often than not, swapping out the GM mid-season doesn't accomplish much. But as you hinted at earlier, the one caveat is that, do you really want this guy dealing with anything at the deadline when he knows his job's at the line, on the line, right? So it's a tough spot
the Flyers
here, right?
Just went through something similar, right? Like that's just kind of what they did month ago, basically.
It's a little different, though, and that's the thing. Like there are a lot of hockey-crazed markets all over the U.S., but when you're in Canada with a hockey-crazed market like Edmonton is, it's different. The pressure these guys feel from the fan base and everyone else in this city, it's immense, you know. And I know for a lot of people who live in the U.S., they really, it's kind of like a lot of people compare it. I know U.S. guys who live out here now that grew up in the States, and they said it's almost like a cross between you take whatever big national sports team, whatever league, beat the NFL, Major League Baseball, basketball, whatever the case may be, and swap it in halfway with, you know, an area where it's a huge college team. again, football or basketball, let's say, especially football. And that's what this is, 24/7. The Oilers are what they breathe. Everyone in this city breathes Oilers 24/7, 365 days a year. So it's a little much. And when they're in the situation that they are, the heat they're feeling is real from the fan base. So lucky for them, the media isn't too bad on them out here. So there's far worse medias in the NHL. Places like Vancouver, Montreal come to mind that are really, really hard on players.
So do you think they end up doing a fire sale at the deadline? Do you think if he is in power, if you're forecasting how things go for the Oilers over the next couple of weeks, how do you see things playing out?
If they're smart, they'll dump some pieces. The thing is, you can only dump so many people. You can't move anything of value, right? There's rumors starting yesterday that they're starving for a forward and they're thinking of trading their first round pick. If these guys trade their first round pick, they're insane.
Their first round pick?
Oh yeah, because what? The only way you can trade that first round pick is if you get a guy who's, you know, a young stud in like 2021, but that isn't going to happen. That deal doesn't happen at the deadline regardless.
Right.
So now the Oilers, to be honest, don't have a lot of tradable assets that people would want, but they do have some pieces that they could move at the deadline. And in my opinion, they can move a lot of those pieces and it doesn't really affect their roster much right now. They should be able to make do. The bottom half of the Western Conference is terrible. So because of it, even if they make trades, if they get decent goaltending, McDavid and Draisaitl can continue to carry the team. They get Oscar Klefbom back from injury. They can still sneak into the playoffs. They're not going anywhere. But they could do that, trades or no trades. So if you can get, as you had mentioned, contracts off the books, then do it. Because there's certain things like, you know, Lucic's contract, guys like that, you can't trade them. They're untradeable. Could you buy them out? Sure, but then you just have dead cap space, which, again, you can't move forward with 6 to 8 million of dead cap space year upon year. So they're in a tough spot. They really are. That said, it's fixable if you get the right GM in here, because the talented guys they do have in here, they're capable enough and talented enough to carry this team, but they have to make some tough decisions. They have to make NHL trades where you trade real players and get real players in return. And you can't keep losing those trades. And unfortunately for Peter Chiarelli, when he decided to trade Taylor Hall, from there on, it snowballed on him. All those deals he lost. And then you are where you are. It's a tough
Would
spot.
Would you guess,
sure,
if they fire Chiarelli that they go like the Kyle Dumas route and they go super young, analytical heavy, and they kind of do, because ultimately that's kind of what you want, is like an Austin Matthews type situation, even though Toronto now has too many good players where like they have some weird stuff where they almost just like miss Nylander with the weird contract stuff, and they have two restrictive free agents, and because I believe Matthews and what's his name, I'm forgetting,
Mitch Marner,
they're both coming up and they're gonna have to pay them both at the same time. That's gonna be tough. And you look at that and you're like, okay, do we go after someone like that who can handle this and put a bunch of talent around our one superstar in Connor McDavid, or do you go with a more traditional GM, kind of like what I think the Islanders tried to do when they were trying to keep Tavares, right? Like they went with the proven commodity in Lou, and they're a good team this year, but it's fine, but they didn't get Tavares, and it's a risk. But I just don't know which way they go, the established route or the young, interesting, intriguing guy that you're like, oh, he's gonna tear down, move a lot of these contracts, and then hope that he can surround Connor McDavid with the right amount of talent so that the Oilers can contend during his prime over the next 3 to 5 years, right?
Yeah, it's tough to say, because the thing is, they're not going to tear it down, because you can't tear this down. Like, they just can't. They can't go through.
This is the Los Angeles Angels situation with Mike Trout.
It's honestly, man, it's turned into that. It really has. And instead of us talking about Pujols, you're talking about Lucic. And it's different, of course, with baseball, because, yeah, you could make things go away if you have great starting pitching, or nowadays an amazing bullpen, and you can kind of go and move pieces. But with hockey, it's really difficult. But McDavid is as good as he is as people think he is, and he really is. For people who don't get to see him all the time, like If you see him on a nightly basis, it's a whole different level. I was lucky enough. I grew up in, when I was a kid, I got to see the Oilers heyday. So I got to see Gretzky through all of it. And it's different. It's a different game. He's a different player. But he's so dominant. If they even do a half-decent job of surrounding him with players, they can fix this thing without ripping it right down to, you know, the studs. As far as the GM goes, I agree with you. They should go that route. But because this is going to be not a full-out rebuild, I don't know if they will. Dubas is a really good GM. It's funny because I watch the Leafs now, and the Leafs aren't really much different than the Oilers. Like, they're really not. The difference is they kept their players, and the Oilers didn't. And because of it, you can see the difference of losing two or three players totally changes what a team can be. And also now,
so it is Kevin Lowe coming back. Is that what we're getting at here?
Well, you know what? If Shirelli were to get canned in season, I guarantee you someone in-house would take over, be it Lowe, be it McTavish, be it whoever, unless they end up keeping, and I know people will say what they say, because Shirelli's assistant GM is actually Keith Gretzky, so people will say that, but Keith Gretzky was, I know it's funny, but to be fair, Keith Gretzky was with Shirelli in Boston, and he's actually seemed to do a pretty good job as an assistant GM, but again, to me, there's a difference between the role of an assistant GM and a GM in the NHL. Assistant GM, you know, does certain things, really helps on the scouting side of it and developing the younger players and who you end up drafting. And that's where this regime has actually done a pretty decent job. They may have pieces coming. But the thing is, too, to be honest with you, the Oilers are in a spot where a lot of the good young GMs have found homes in the last two or three years in the NHL. So there's not many of those guys brewing under the surface. There's probably still one or two out there. But if I were to bet money on it, I'd almost guarantee they go not old school, but they'll probably go old school to a degree.
Which is weird because their owner's young. He's 57.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not like they have an old stoggy owner. He's like the same age as Lowe, I want to say, like somewhere around that. Like, he's someone you would think that would embrace that kind of approach. No, as painful as it would be to kind of waste a couple seasons with Connor McDavid on your hands, I just don't see another avenue. I don't see a retooling situation putting them over the top of McDavid. So it's a tough thing, but they did this to themselves. Edmonton did this to themselves.
They're in a very difficult spot, but like I said, you could move it along where in a couple of years' time, they could probably still be really good, but in the next couple of years, be much better than they are. Like, there's no reason for them to be struggling to the extent that they did or that they are, but the reason they are is anyone who has two eyes and can see what's going on. You know, I've been saying it for two seasons, and many of the articles I've written over at the Hockey Writers and via Twitter and all sorts of different platforms that I might be on. People thought I was crazy when the Oilers went on their run in 16-17 and got into the playoffs, looked really good, should have beat Anaheim but lost. But you could see even then where everyone here was so thrilled that they made the playoffs. It had been so long, like either they had never lived through this at all, or it had been so long for other fans that they forgot what it was like. But when you looked at that lineup, you had to realize that it was the only way it could continue is if the secondary pieces continue to click on all levels, which never happens with those players. Mm-hmm. Everyone stays healthy, which never happens. And the goaltender in Cam Talbot, who's at the time a pretty good goaltender, but had a career year. Like, he ended up just outside of the voting for the Vezina. He ended up fourth. He's not a top five goaltender in the NHL. This year, when the Oilers have had success, when they've went on extended winning runs, there hasn't been many, but there's been a couple. It's been because Talbot's been really good, or Mikko Koskinen, who's the backup they brought in this year, has been stellar. You add that to McDavid doing what McDavid does, they're going to win games. But to do that over 82 games plus playoffs, it's just not, year in, year out, it's just not practical.
I think you just described the Ducks without a superstar.
Yeah. I hear you.
And a better goalie.
Yeah.
I mean, the Ducks haven't won since, what, November, basically? Like, they've just, it's killing me what's going on in Anaheim. But, yeah,
but to be fair,
it's not great.
The only reason the Ducks were even in anything the first month and a half of the season was because of John Gibson.
Right.
He won games by himself, like 100%. week in, week out. But again, as good a goalie as that guy is, and in my opinion, he is a top five goalie in the league, if not higher, at some point, pucks go in. Like, it's
right.
Just,
I mean, especially when your team is scoring. I think I want to. They're not dead last in points scored, but I think they're second to last.
Yeah.
I think, last time I checked, it's a putrid offense.
Yeah.
And I believe the offseason thing was like, they're not going to be slow moving. They're going to be faster. They're going to be this new brand identity and all this kind of stuff. And it has not unfolded that way on the ice.
Yeah, and you've seen the same thing with LA, right? You've heard people at the Kings say the same thing.
But at least they bottomed out.
Yeah,
like they're
true.
Just bad, and they just know they're going to be bad for a while.
Well, and that's the problem with a team like LA, right? Whereas at least you can say the Oilers have some issues with the cap, which they do, but the guys making the majority of money on their team, outside of a couple of guys, are their best players. When you look at a team like LA, you got a couple of guys, that are still in their prime, but even a guy like Kopitar, who's still a very good player, he's making obscene money that's going to start killing them in a couple of years. But again, and I know you mentioned Chicago earlier, but at least Chicago,
I feel like they're in a worse situation because you're going to take Crawford, right? Potentially.
Yeah, I agree.
He doesn't have any more concussions, but
But Chicago, you can take because they won three cups. And LA, you can take.
And the Kings
to a degree
won two,
well.
Though.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. In LA, you can as well. But the problem I find with LA is some of the decisions they've made recently make no sense. Mm. Where Chicago, they made a lot of their decisions before. Their one big mistake, which anyone, again, who knows anything about anything, was their signing of Seabrook to the deal that they did when they did. But, again, that's, you got to take it that part of the equation out that they're winners before. We saw this with the Islanders in the 80s. Different time, different money, different era. But the Islanders kept everyone way too long and then were god-awful forever. And that was because they didn't trade any of those guys.
Before it was too late, and they just wrote it out, and then they had nothing left in the cupboard, and it was
bad,
because you got to kind of set back a little bit so you can get some new, young, intriguing talent in the pipeline and kind of make it sustainable. But that's one of the most difficult things in sports, I think, is bouncing out, winning now, while also not screwing yourself over for 10 years of just awful rebuilding. Because, I mean, the Phillies did that with Ruben Amaro, where they went all in, they traded all their prospect capital, and they won a World Series, and it was great, but then they just have gone through a decade of just hell. And the rebuilding, and it's a lot more difficult when you're in a big market like that and all that. It's tough. It turns out running a sports team, actually difficult. But maybe Colby Cave is the answer in Edmonton. We haven't talked about him. The former Boston Bruin legend, Colby Cave. Are we sure he's not the answer to Connor McDavid's sidekick woes?
My answer would be to that, probably not. But we'll see. it's still too early to say, but my answer would be no, without question.
Okay.
So we'll
what is the end of season expectations for you then for this team? Do they sneak into the playoffs? Do they still have around 500 and make it? Do they make it, or do they finish at around 500 and just miss, or do they bottom out by firing their GM and just completely unloading and changing direction? Like, how do you see it going?
I don't foresee them making the playoffs. I really don't. But if they made it, would I be surprised? No, I wouldn't, because he's that good. McDavid is that good. He can take this team and drag and will them to, points here and there to get. And as I mentioned earlier, the conference is terrible. So because the conference isn't very good at the bottom, where the Oilers have kind of shot themselves in the foot to a degree, is their recent struggles have parlayed with Vegas getting hot, San Jose finding their game, and Calgary turning it up a notch. So originally, a lot of people thought, oh, they might have a chance to sneak in third in the Pacific. But right now, the top three teams in the Pacific, you could argue, at least from a regular season standpoint, are on the same level as Nashville and Winnipeg, because they are, from a point standpoint. So they're not going to win that. They're not going to be able to grab that third spot in their division. So then it comes down to one of the last wild cards. And those other teams just aren't very good. Minnesota's flawed. Colorado's flawed. St. Louis, I think, is going to get in the mix, and they've been god-awful all year. So they'll get back in it. There's teams down there in Anaheim, as we mentioned earlier. Again, they're going to win the odd game.
They're cooked. There's just no way to solve that offense issue. There's nothing you can do.
But again, and I don't disagree, but again, Gibson's going to get hot again. And when he does, he's going to win them points on his own. So because
well,
he's
Bettman
capable
has to step
of doing
in.
That,
if this team makes the playoffs, he has to just say no. We're not putting this on television. This is not happening. You're not winning a playoff game 1-0. This we're not allowing it.
That's what you're looking at, though, from an Anaheim standpoint, for sure. But yeah, so do I think the Oilers make the playoffs? Probably not. Could they sneak in? For sure. They're not going to bottom out. That just won't happen. This market will not allow for them to bottom out. They just won't. And this ownership group as well and management team, they want to make the playoffs. If nothing else, just to say they made the playoffs, which is an asinine way of looking at things.
Fans aren't dumb. Yep. This is a different era. Like, they can see through that stuff. I don't know why owners talk themselves into that. We're like, see, we made the playoffs. Look, we're moving in the right direction. It's like fans are smart. They read. They know what's going on. They know what you're doing.
And the funny thing is, too, this market very much so from an online, shall we say, blogosphere, that sort of thing. There's a lot of fans who know what they're talking about that follow this team or that are in the city. But for me, out of all the sports, I think the ones you're really starting to see it actually happen more in transition is in baseball, right? Teams are now, it's getting to the point where it's too much in baseball, where teams are just like, yeah, no, we're good. We're going to suck. And three quarters of
the league
is going to suck.
Oh, yeah. Because no one's paying. And then it just screws over the veterans because they're like, oh, would we pay a 22-year-old $600,000 versus Mike Moustakas, this 32-year-old veteran who's worked his whole life to get to this point to get a nice little payday at the end of his career? They're like, what if we just didn't do that? Do they have an option? So it turns out putting a lot of capital investors and all this kind of stuff in front offices kind of makes things difficult for people wanting to get compensated the right way when they are out of arbitration and are ready to kind of cash in at the end of their careers. It's a really healthy system in Major League Baseball, I would say. It's great. Things are great.
At least the National League should be challenging this year, I think. The American League is going to be unwatchable. But at least with the National League, you're starting to see some teams that I think there'll be a few teams. It'll be interesting. But the difference, too, with baseball that you look at a guy like Josh Donaldson. Yeah, the Braves may have overpaid him a little bit, but it's 1 year. So
it's all about years.
Matter.
That's what it is. Teams will overpay for a year. It's what, and that's, I mean, that's, I think, all sports with Dumas and every other young, interesting GM that comes up. Like, I think that's all they care about. It's like they're okay with signing up for long-term deals with young talent that are going to age gracefully, that kind of stuff. And you lock in your superstars, but you don't spend, you don't lock yourself into Evan Turner type deals and like Philly did years ago. Or like you don't do what the Braves did with Frank Wren, where you double down on the Upton's and all these other guys. And you're like, oh, this is not going to end well. And then you have to sell all those pieces and you have to go through this another painful rebuild. Like, teams are just, I feel like everybody has a GM kind of like each other now. They're just just a lot of former finance guys all just getting in a room and seeing how it's all complicated. I could rant about the Major League Baseball front office issue all the time, but I would just encourage people to read John Taylor in Sports Illustrated, friend of the pod, outlining the current state of baseball's CBA and just everything going on there. But all right, man, well, the Oilers, go watch Connor McDavid. I know it's tough with if you're an Oilers fan because you want to see him win more games, but he is a special player and he's fun to watch, and he's appointment viewing. So even if the Oilers keep doing Oiler things, at least you'll know you can watch a hockey game where this dude is just able to do things that hockey players should not be able to do.
Very true. And like you said, every night there's something where the kid will wow you. So if nothing else, you get that. And hopefully, starting this summer, the Oilers will stop doing Oilers things and try and rectify this issue moving forward.
Like stealing Ken Holland away from Detroit. What could go wrong?
Hey, man, the thing here from the moment he left, decided to leave Tampa Bay, all people talk about here is, they need to get Steve Yzerman. It's like Yzerman left Tampa for a reason. And it wasn't to go, if he goes anywhere, it's going to be Detroit.
That was a weird story, though. Remember, like, that's still just, that was a weird thing.
I really think with Yzerman, it was honestly just strictly family, right?
But you just never see that in sports, like, especially at the top when you're, like, you've built this winner like this and everything else, and they're just this points for just juggernaut, and just to walk away like that, it's just weird.
Well, and especially because they hadn't won. Like, they hadn't won. They had great seasons,
right,
but they never won a cup with him running
the
show.
They don't win it this year, man. Oh.
Well, And you never know. And that's the thing with hockey, right? Hockey's very, it's funny. Hockey, it's no different. I guess baseball's like that too. Basketball's the one sport where it's not so much like that. But baseball, if a team gets hot or a pitcher gets hot or someone's slumping, you can go like that. NHL, same thing. If a goalie gets hot or a guy goes on a heater for a week, anyone can beat anyone. You know, like they really can. No team in the playoffs will be terrible. And I'll tell you this, even if the Oilers were to sneak into the playoffs, would I expect them to do anything? No. But would I be shocked if they knock someone off in the first round? No, not at all. They got the best player on the planet. Who says he can't do enough to win 4 out of 7? Of course he could. You know, it's a goal or two difference here or there. If the guy's putting up 2 to 3 points a game over a 7-game series, well.
And you have a hot goalie. Like, yeah. It's more than doable, yeah.
Yeah. So that's just how it is, right? And both those sports are like that. So be it baseball or hockey. So that's the thing, right? You don't know. And that's why so many of them say you just need to get there. And it's true. You just need to get there. And, yeah, chances of them making a run, not good. But, you know, the problem, though, to be honest,
you never
Matt,
know.
If they were to win a round, that would make it worse. Because then people will be like, oh, see, it's good. They're headed in the right direction.
Things are better than ever. And then you're back to where you started a couple of years ago, where they just add on all these more bad contracts, and you're just going more salary cap hell. And oh, God. I'm just giving a bunch of Oilers fans seizures right now. Rob,
nothing they're not used to, man. Nothing they're not used to.
Oh, my God. Rob, I really appreciate it. We can follow you on Twitter at oil_drop. We can read you at thehockeywriters.com. Is there anything you want to plug before we get out of here real quick?
No, I'm good, man. Just the site. Head over there as much as possible. I took a bit of a hiatus over the holiday season. I'm just starting up again. And a couple of years back, I did write a book on Connor McDavid, Hockey's Next Great One, which you can get through Amazon. That was in April 2017, I guess. So, yeah, right around the corner.
So are you going to send me over a promotional copy?
You bet, buddy.
Having on the podcast?
No problem. I can do that
for you. Oh, perfect. All right. I'll read it. Rob, thank you so much, and let's talk again soon, sir.
You bet. Thanks again for having me. It was a pleasure. Take care.
And that'll do it for today's episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast. I just want to remind you guys, if you like today's episode and you are subscribed on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, I would really appreciate if you could take a second, leave the show a 5-star rating and a review. If you're not an Apple Podcast listener, remember you can find the show on Spotify, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Be sure to check out ChaseThomasPodcast.com, where you can access all of my previous episodes and also find all my writing. I'm writing there fairly often. And also follow me on Twitter at Chase_Thomas and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. Thank you for your support, and we'll be back with another episode very soon. Thanks, guys.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a 4-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.